He ought to trust me and not act as if I was a baby. It's no use, Joe. He's got to learn that I'm able to take care of myself and don't need anyone's apron string to hold on by. What pepper pots you are, sighed Joe. How do you mean to settle this affair? Well, he ought to beg pardon and believe me when I say I can't tell him what the fuss is about. Bless you, he won't do that. I won't go down till he does. Now, Teddy, be sensible. Let it pass and I'll explain what I can. You can't stay here, so what's the use of being melodramatic? I don't intend to stay here long anyway. I'll slip off and take a journey somewhere, and when Grandpa misses me, he'll come round fast enough. I dare say, but you ought not to go and worry him. Don't preach. I'll go to Washington and see Brooke. It's gay there, and I'll enjoy myself after the troubles. What fun you'd have! I wish I could run off, too, said Joe, forgetting her part of mentor in lively visions of martial life at the Capitol. Come on, then. Why not? You go and surprise your father, and I'll stir up old Brooke. It would be a glorious joke. Let's do it, Joe. We'll leave a letter saying we are all right and trot off at once. I've got money enough. It will do you good and no harm as you go to your father. For a moment, Joe looked as if she would agree, for wild as the plan was, it just suited her. She was tired of care and confinement, longed for change, and thoughts of her father blended temptingly with the novel charms of camps and hospitals, liberty and fun. Her eyes kindled as they turned wistfully toward the window, but they fell on the old house opposite, and she shook her head with sorrowful decision. If I was a boy, we'd run away together and have a capital time, but as I'm a miserable girl, I must be proper and stop at home. Don't tempt me, Teddy. It's a crazy plan. That's the fun of it, began Laurie, who had got a willful fit on him and was possessed to break out of bounds in some way. Hold your tongue, cried Joe, covering her ears. Prunes and prisms are my doom, and I may as well make up my mind to it. I came here to moralize, not to hear things that make me skip to think of. I know Meg would wet blanket such a proposal, but I thought you had more spirit, began Laurie insinuatingly. Bad boy, be quiet. Sit down and think of your own sins. Don't go making me add to mine. If I get your grandpa to apologize for the shaking, will you give up running away? Asked Joe seriously. Yes, but you won't do it, answered Laurie, who wished to make up, but felt that his outraged dignity must be appeased first. If I can manage the young one, I can the old one, muttered Joe as she walked away, leaving Laurie bent over a railroad map with his head propped up on both hands. Come in. And Mr. Lawrence's gruff voice sounded gruffer than ever as Joe tapped at his door. It's only me, sir, come to return a book, she said blandly as she entered. Want any more? Asked the old gentleman, looking grim and vexed, but trying not to show it. Yes, please. I like old Sam so well, I think I'll try the second volume, returned Joe, hoping to propitiate him by accepting a second dose of Boswell's Johnson, as he had recommended that lively work. The shaggy eyebrows unbent a little as he rolled the steps toward the shelf where the Johnsonian literature was placed. Joe skipped up, and sitting on the top step, affected to be searching for her book, but was really wondering how best to introduce the dangerous object of her visit. Mr. Lawrence seemed to suspect that something was brewing in her mind, for after taking several brisk turns about the room, he faced round on her, speaking so abruptly that Rasselas tumbled face downward on the floor. What has that boy been about? Don't try to shield him. I know he has been in mischief by the way he acted when he came home. I can't get a word from him, and when I threatened to shake the truth out of him, he bolted upstairs and locked himself into his room. He did wrong, but we forgave him, and all promised not to say a word to anyone, began Joe reluctantly. That won't do. He shall not shelter himself behind a promise from you soft-hearted girls. If he's done anything amiss, he shall confess, beg pardon, and be punished. Out with it, Joe. I won't be kept in the dark. Mr. Lawrence looked so alarming and spoke so sharply that Joe would have gladly run away, if she could, but she was perched aloft on the steps, and he stood at the foot, a lion in the path, so she had to stay and brave it out. Indeed, sir, I cannot tell. Mother forbade it. Laurie has confessed, asked pardon, and been punished quite enough. We don't keep silence to shield him, but someone else, and it will make more trouble if you interfere. Please don't. It was partly my fault, but it's all right now. So let's forget it and talk about the Rambler, or something pleasant.
Hang the Rambler. Come down and give me your word that this harum-scarum boy of mine hasn't done anything ungrateful or impertinent. If he has, after all your kindness to him, I'll thrash him with my own hands.
The threat sounded awful, but did not alarm Jo, for she knew the irascible old gentleman would never lift a finger against his grandson, whatever he might say to the contrary. She obediently descended, and made as light of the prank as she could, without betraying Meg or forgetting the truth.
Well, if the boy held his tongue because he promised, and not from obstinacy, I'll forgive him. He's a stubborn fellow and hard to manage, said Mr. Lawrence,
rubbing up his hair till it looked as if he had been out in a gale, and smoothing the frown from his brow with an air of relief. So am I, but a kind word will govern me when all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't, said Jo, trying to say a kind word for her friend, who seemed to get out of one scrape only to fall into another.
You think I'm not kind to him, hey? Was the sharp answer.
Oh, dear, no, sir. You are rather too kind sometimes, and then just a trifle hasty when he tries your patience. Don't you think you are? Jo was determined to have it out now, and tried to look quite placid, though she quaked a little after her bold speech. To her great relief and surprise, the old gentleman only threw his spectacles onto the table with a rattle and exclaimed frankly,
"You're right, girl. I am. I love the boy, but he tries my patience past bearing, and I know how it will end if we go on so."
"I'll tell you, he'll run away." Jo was sorry for that speech the minute it was made. She meant to warn him that Laurie would not bear much restraint, and hoped he would be more forbearing with the lad. Mr. Lawrence's ruddy face changed suddenly, and he sat down, with a troubled glance at the picture of a handsome man which hung over his table. It was Laurie's father, who had run away in his youth, and married against the imperious old man's will. Jo fancied he remembered and regretted the past, and she wished she'd held her tongue. "He won't do it unless he is very much worried, and only threatens it sometimes when he gets tired of studying. I often think I should like to, especially since my hair was cut, so if you ever miss us, you may advertise for two boys and look among the ships bound for India." She laughed as she spoke, and Mr. Lawrence looked relieved, evidently taking the whole as a joke.
"You hussy, how dare you talk in that way? Where is your respect for me and your proper bringing up? Bless the boys and girls. What torments they are, yet we can't do without them," he said,
pinching her cheeks good-humoredly.
"Go and bring that boy down to his dinner. Tell him it's all right, and advise him not to put on tragedy airs with his grandfather. I won't bear it."
"He won't come, sir. He feels badly because you didn't believe him when he said he couldn't tell. I think the shaking hurt his feelings very much." Jo tried to look pathetic, but must have failed, for Mr. Lawrence began to laugh, and she knew the day was won.
"I'm sorry for that, and ought to thank him for not shaking me, I suppose. What the dickens does the fellow expect?"
And the old gentleman looked a trifle ashamed of his own testiness. "If I were you, I'd write him an apology, sir. He says he won't come down till he has one, and talks about Washington, and goes on in an absurd way. A formal apology will make him see how foolish he is, and bring him down quite amiable. Try it. He likes fun, and this way is better than talking. I'll carry it up and teach him his duty." Mr. Lawrence gave her a sharp look and put on his spectacles, saying slowly,
"You're a sly puss, but I don't mind being managed by you and Beth. Here, give me a bit of paper and let us have done with this nonsense."
The note was written in the terms which one gentleman would use to another after offering some deep insult. Jo dropped a kiss on the top of Mr. Lawrence's bald head and ran up to slip the apology under Laurie's door, advising him through the keyhole to be submissive, decorous, and a few other agreeable impossibilities. Finding the door locked again, she left the note to do its work, and was going quietly away when the young gentleman slid down the banisters and waited for her at the bottom, saying, with his most virtuous expression of countenance,
"What a good fellow you are, Jo! Did you get blown up?" he added, laughing.
"No, he was pretty mild on the whole."
"Ah, I got it all round. Even you cast me off over there, and I felt just ready to go to the deuce, he began apologetically.
Don't talk that way. Turn over a new leaf and begin again, Teddy, my son.
I keep turning over new leaves and spoiling them, as I used to spoil my copybooks, and I make so many beginnings there never will be an end, he said dolefully.
Go and eat your dinner. You'll feel better after it. Men always croak when they are hungry. And Joe whisked out at the front door after that.
That's a label on my sect, answered Lori,
quoting Amy, as he went to partake of humble pie, dutifully, with his grandfather, who was quite saintly in temper and overwhelmingly respectful in manner all the rest of the day. Everyone thought the matter ended and the little cloud blown over, but the mischief was done, for though others forgot it, Meg remembered. She never alluded to a certain person, but she thought of him a good deal, dreamed dreams more than ever, and once Joe, rummaging her sister's desk for stamps, found a bit of paper scribbled over with the words, Mrs. John Brooke, whereat she groaned tragically and cast it into the fire, feeling that Lori's prank had hastened the evil day for her. Chapter 22. Pleasant Meadows. Like sunshine after a storm were the peaceful weeks which followed. The invalids improved rapidly, and Mr. March began to talk of returning early in the new year. Beth was soon able to lie on the study sofa all day, amusing herself with the well-beloved cats at first, and in time with doll sewing, which had fallen sadly behind hand. Her once active limbs were so stiff and feeble that Joe took her for a daily airing about the house in her strong arms. Meg cheerfully blackened and burned her white hands, cooking delicate messes for the dear, while Amy, a loyal slave of the ring, celebrated her return by giving away as many of her treasures as she could prevail on her sisters to accept. As Christmas approached, the usual mysteries began to haunt the house, and Joe frequently convulsed the family by proposing utterly impossible or magnificently absurd ceremonies in honor of this unusually merry Christmas. Lori was equally impracticable and would have had bonfires, skyrockets, and triumphal arches if he had had his own way. After many skirmishes and snubbings, the ambitious pair were considered effectually quenched and went about with forlorn faces, which were rather belied by explosions of laughter when the two got together. Several days of unusually mild weather fitly ushered in a splendid Christmas day. Hannah felt in her bones that it was going to be an unusually fine day, and she proved herself a true prophetess, for everybody and everything seemed bound to produce a grand success. To begin with, Mr. March wrote that he should soon be with them. Then Beth felt uncommonly well that morning, and, being dressed in her mother's gift, a soft crimson merino wrapper, was borne in high triumph to the window to behold the offering of Joe and Lori. The Unquenchables had done their best to be worthy of the name, for like elves, they had worked by night and conjured up a comical surprise. Out in the garden stood a stately snow maiden, crowned with holly, bearing a basket of fruit and flowers in one hand, a great roll of music in the other, a perfect rainbow of an afghan round her chilly shoulders, and a Christmas carol issuing from her lips on a pink paper streamer. The Jungfrau to Beth. God bless you, dear Queen Bess. May nothing you dismay, but health and peace and happiness be yours this Christmas day. Here's fruit to feed our busy bee, and flowers for her nose. Here's music for her peony, an afghan for her toes. A portrait of Joanna, see, by Raphael number 2, who labored with great industry to make it fair and true. Except a ribbon red, I beg, from Madame Purrer's tale, and ice cream made by lovely Peg, a Mont Blanc in a pail. Their dearest love my makers laid within my breast of snow, except it and the Alpine maid from Lori and from Joe. How Beth laughed when she saw it, how Lori ran up and down to bring in the gifts, and what ridiculous speeches Joe made as she presented them. I'm so full of happiness that if Father was only here, I couldn't hold one drop more, said Beth, quite sighing with contentment as Joe carried her off to the study to rest after the excitement and to refresh herself with some of the delicious grapes the Jungfrau had sent her. So am I, added Joe, slapping the pocket wherein reposed the long-desired Undine and Sintram. I'm sure I am, echoed Amy, poring over the engraved copy of the Madonna and Child, which her mother had given her in a pretty frame. "Of course I am," cried Meg, smoothing the silvery folds of her first silk dress, for Mr. Lawrence had insisted on giving it. "How can I be otherwise?" said Mrs. March gratefully, as her eyes went from her husband's letter to Beth's smiling face, and her hand caressed the brooch made of gray and golden, chestnut and dark brown hair, which the girls had just fastened on her breast. Now and then in this workaday world, things do happen in the delightful storybook fashion, and what a comfort it is. Half an hour after everyone had said they were so happy they could only hold one drop more, the drop came. Laurie opened the parlor door and popped his head in very quietly. He might just as well have turned a somersault and uttered an Indian war whoop, for his face was so full of suppressed excitement and his voice so treacherously joyful that everyone jumped up, though he only said in a queer, breathless voice, "Here's another Christmas present for the March family." Before the words were well out of his mouth, he was whisked away somehow, and in his place appeared a tall man, muffled up to the eyes, leaning on the arm of another tall man, who tried to say something and couldn't. Of course, there was a general stampede, and for several minutes everybody seemed to lose their wits, for the strangest things were done, and no one said a word. Mr. March became invisible in the embrace of four pairs of loving arms. Jo disgraced herself by nearly fainting away and had to be doctored by Laurie in the china closet. Mr. Brooke kissed Meg entirely by mistake, as he somewhat incoherently explained. And Amy, the dignified, tumbled over a stool and, never stopping to get up, hugged and cried over her father's boots in the most touching manner. Mrs. March was the first to recover herself and held up her hand with a warning. "Hush! Remember Beth!" But it was too late. The study door flew open, the little red wrapper appeared on the threshold, joy put strength into the feeble limbs, and Beth ran straight into her father's arms. Never mind what happened just after that, for the full hearts overflowed, washing away the bitterness of the past and leaving only the sweetness of the present. It was not at all romantic, but a hearty laugh set everybody straight again, for Hannah was discovered behind the door, sobbing over the fat turkey, which she'd forgotten to put down when she rushed up from the kitchen. As the laugh subsided, Mrs. March began to thank Mr. Brooke for his faithful care of her husband, at which Mr. Brooke suddenly remembered that Mr. March needed rest, and, seizing Laurie, he precipitately retired. Then the two invalids were ordered to repose, which they did, by both sitting in one big chair and talking hard. Mr. March told how he had longed to surprise them, and how, when the fine weather came, he'd been allowed by his doctor to take advantage of it, how devoted Brooke had been, and how he was altogether a most estimable and upright young man. Why, Mr. March paused a minute just there, and after a glance at Meg, who was violently poking the fire, looked at his wife with an inquiring lift of the eyebrows, I leave you to imagine. Also, why Mrs. March gently nodded her head and asked, rather abruptly, if he wouldn't like to have something to eat. Jo saw and understood the look, and she stalked grimly away to get wine and beef tea, muttering to herself as she slammed the door, "I hate estimable young men with brown eyes." There never was such a Christmas dinner as they had that day. The fat turkey was a sight to behold when Hannah sent him up, stuffed, browned, and decorated. So was the plum pudding, which melted in one's mouth, likewise the jellies, in which Amy reveled like a fly in a honey pot. Everything turned out well, which was a mercy, Hannah said. "For my mind was that flustered, Mum, that it's a miracle I didn't roast the pudding and stuff the turkey with raisins, let alone billin' of it in a cloth." Mr. Lawrence and his grandson dined with them, also Mr. Brooke, at whom Jo glowered darkly, to Laurie's infinite amusement. Two easy chairs stood side by side at the head of the table, in which sat Beth and her father, feasting modestly on chicken and a little fruit. They drank healths, told stories, sang songs, reminisced, as the old folks say, and had a thoroughly good time. A sleigh ride had been planned, but the girls would not leave their father, so the guests departed early, and as twilight gathered, the happy family sat together round the fire. "Just a year ago, we were groaning over the dismal Christmas we expected to have. Do you remember?" asked Jo, breaking a short pause which had followed a long conversation about many things. "Rather a pleasant year on the whole," said Meg, smiling at the fire,
and congratulating herself on having treated Mr. Brooke with dignity.
"I think it's been a pretty hard one," observed Amy, watching the light shine on her ring with thoughtful eyes.
"I'm glad it's over, because we've got you back," whispered Beth, who sat on her father's knee.
"Rather a rough road for you to travel, my little pilgrims, especially the latter part of it. But you have got on bravely, and I think the burdens are in a fair way to tumble off very soon," said Mr. March, looking with fatherly satisfaction at the four young faces gathered round him.
"How do you know? Did Mother tell you?" asked Joe.
"Not much. Straws show which way the wind blows, and I've made several discoveries today."
"Oh, tell us what they are," cried Meg, who sat beside him.
"Here is one."
And taking up the hand which lay on the arm of his chair, he pointed to the roughened forefinger, a burn on the back, and two or three little hard spots on the palm.
"I remember a time when this hand was white and smooth, and your first care was to keep it so. It was very pretty then, but to me it is much prettier now, for in this seeming blemishes I read a little history. A burnt offering has been made to vanity. This hardened palm has earned something better than blisters, and I'm sure the sewing done by these pricked fingers will last a long time. So much goodwill went into the stitches. Meg, my dear, I value the womanly skill which keeps home happy more than white hands or fashionable accomplishments. I'm proud to shake this good, industrious little hand, and hope I shall not soon be asked to give it away."
If Meg had wanted a reward for hours of patient labor, she received it in the hearty pressure of her father's hand and the approving smile he gave her.
"What about Joe? Please say something nice, for she has tried so hard and been so very, very good to me," said Beth in her father's ear.
He laughed and looked across at the tall girl who sat opposite, with an unusually mild expression in her face.
"In spite of the curly crop, I don't see the son Joe, whom I left a year ago," said Mr. March. "I see a young lady who pins her collar straight, laces her boots neatly, and neither whistles, talks slang, nor lies on the rug as she used to do. Her face is rather thin and pale just now, with watching and anxiety, but I like to look at it, for it has grown gentler and her voice is lower. She doesn't bounce, but moves quietly and takes care of a certain little person in a motherly way which delights me. I rather miss my wild girl, but if I get a strong, helpful, tender-hearted woman in her place, I shall feel quite satisfied. I don't know whether the shearing sobered our black sheep, but I do know that in all Washington I couldn't find anything beautiful enough to be bought with the $5 and $20 my good girl sent me."
Joe's keen eyes were rather dim for a minute, and her thin face grew rosy in the firelight as she received her father's praise, feeling that she did deserve a portion of it.
"Now, Beth," said Amy, longing for her turn, but ready to wait.
"There's so little of her, I'm afraid to say much, for fear she will slip away altogether, though she is not so shy as she used to be," began their father cheerfully.
But recollecting how nearly he had lost her, he held her close, saying tenderly, with her cheek against his own,
"I've got you safe, my Beth, and I'll keep you so, please God."
After a minute's silence, he looked down at Amy, who sat on the cricket at his feet, and said, with a caress of the shining hair,
"I observed that Amy took drumsticks at dinner, ran errands for her mother all the afternoon, gave Meg her place tonight, and has waited on everyone with patience and good humor. I also observe that she does not fret much, nor look in the glass, and has not even mentioned a very pretty ring which she wears, so I conclude that she has learned to think of other people more and of herself less, and has decided to try and mold her character as carefully as she molds her little clay figures. I am glad of this, for though I should be very proud of a graceful statue made by her, I shall be infinitely prouder of a lovable daughter with a talent for making life beautiful to herself and others."
"What are you thinking of, Beth?" asked Joe, when Amy had thanked her father and told about her ring.
"I read in Pilgrim's Progress today how, after many troubles, Christian and Hopeful came to a pleasant green meadow where lilies bloomed all year round, and there they rested happily, as we do now, before they went on to their journey's end," answered Beth,
adding, as she slipped out of her father's arms and went to the instrument, "It's singing time now, and I want to be in my old place. I'll try to sing the song of the shepherd boy, which the pilgrims heard. I made the music for father, because he likes the verses." So, sitting at the dear little piano, Beth softly touched the keys, and in the sweet voice they'd never thought to hear again, sang to her own accompaniment the quaint hymn, which was a singularly fitting song for her. "He that is down need fear no fall, he that is low no pride, he that is humble ever shall have God to be his guide. I am content with what I have, little be it or much, and, Lord, contentment still I crave, because thou savest such. Fullness to them a burden is that go on pilgrimage. Here little and hereafter bliss is best from age to age." Chapter 23. Aunt March Settles the Question. Like bees swarming after their queen, mother and daughters hovered about Mr. March the next day, neglecting everything to look at, wait upon, and listen to the new invalid, who was in a fair way to be killed by kindness. As he sat propped up in a big chair by Beth's sofa, with the other three close by, and Hannah popping in her head now and then, to peek at the dear man, nothing seemed needed to complete their happiness. But something was needed, and the elder ones felt it, though none confessed the fact. Mr. and Mrs. March looked at one another with an anxious expression as their eyes followed Meg. Jo had sudden fits of sobriety and was seen to shake her fist at Mr. Brooke's umbrella, which had been left in the hall. Meg was absent-minded, shy, and silent, started when the bell rang, and colored when John's name was mentioned. Amy said, "Everyone seemed waiting for something and couldn't settle down, which was queer, since Father was safe at home." And Beth innocently wondered why their neighbors didn't run over as usual. Lori went by in the afternoon, and seeing Meg at the window, seemed suddenly possessed with a melodramatic fit, for he fell down on one knee in the snow, beat his breast, tore his hair, and clasped his hands imploringly, as if begging some boon. And when Meg told him to behave himself and go away, he wrung imaginary tears out of his handkerchief and staggered round the corner as if in utter despair. "What does the goose mean?" said Meg, laughing and trying to look unconscious. "He's showing you how your John will go on by and by. Touching, isn't it?" answered Jo scornfully. "Don't say my John. It isn't proper or true." But Meg's voice lingered over the words as if they sounded pleasant to her. "Please don't plague me, Jo. I've told you I don't care much about him, and there isn't to be anything said, but we are all to be friendly and go on as before." "We can't, for something has been said, and Lori's mischief has spoiled you for me. I see it, and so does Mother. You are not like your old self a bit, and seem ever so far away from me. I don't mean to plague you, and will bear it like a man, but I do wish it was all settled. I hate to wait, so if you mean ever to do it, make haste and have it over quickly," said Jo pettishly. "I can't say anything till he speaks, and he won't, because Father said I was too young," began Meg, bending over her work with a queer little smile, which suggested that she did not quite agree with her father on that point. "If he did speak, you wouldn't know what to say, but would cry or blush, or let him have his own way, instead of giving a good, decided no." "I'm not so silly and weak as you think. I know just what I should say, for I've planned it all, so I needn't be taken unawares. There's no knowing what may happen, and I wish to be prepared." Jo couldn't help smiling at the important air which Meg had unconsciously assumed, and which was as becoming as the pretty color varying in her cheeks. "Would you mind telling me what you'd say?" asked Jo, more respectfully. "Not at all. You are 16 now, quite old enough to be my confidant, and my experience will be useful to you by and by, perhaps in your own affairs of this sort." "Don't mean to have any. It's fun to watch other people philander, but I should feel like a fool doing it myself," said Jo, looking alarmed at the thought. "I think not, if you liked anyone very much and he liked you." Meg spoke as if to herself and glanced out at the lane where she'd often seen lovers walking together in the summer twilight. "I thought you were going to tell your speech to that man," said Jo, rudely shortening her sister's little reverie. "Oh, I should merely say, quite calmly and decidedly, thank you, Mr. Brooke, you are very kind.
but I agree with Father that I'm too young to enter into any engagement at present. So please, say no more, but let us be friends as we were.
That's stiff and cool enough. I don't believe you'll ever say it, and I know he won't be satisfied if you do. If he goes on like the rejected lovers in books, you'll give in rather than hurt his feelings.
No, I won't. I shall tell him I've made up my mind and shall walk out of the room with dignity. Meg rose as she spoke and was just going to rehearse the dignified exit when a step in the hall made her fly into her seat and begin to sew as fast as if her life depended on finishing that particular seam in a given time. Joe smothered a laugh at the sudden change, and when someone gave a modest tap, opened the door with a grim aspect which was anything but hospitable.
Good afternoon. I came to get my umbrella, that is, to see how your father finds himself today, said Mr. Brooke, getting a trifle confused as his eyes went from one telltale face to the other.
It's very well. He's in the rack. I'll get him and tell it you are here.
And having jumbled her father and the umbrella well together in her reply, Jo slipped out of the room to give Meg a chance to make her speech and air her dignity. But the instant she vanished, Meg began to sidle toward the door, murmuring,
Mother will like to see you. Pray sit down. I'll call her.
Don't go. Are you afraid of me, Margaret?
And Mr. Brooke looked so hurt that Meg thought she must have done something very rude. She blushed up to the little curls on her forehead, for he had never called her Margaret before, and she was surprised to find how natural and sweet it seemed to hear him say it. Anxious to appear friendly and at her ease, she put out her hand with a confiding gesture and said gratefully,
How can I be afraid when you have been so kind to Father? I only wish I could thank you for it.
Shall I tell you how? Asked Mr. Brooke, holding the small hand fast in both his own and looking down at Meg with so much love in the brown eyes that her heart began to flutter, and she both longed to run away and to stop and listen.
Oh, no, please don't. I'd rather not, she said, trying to withdraw her hand and looking frightened in spite of her denial.
I won't trouble you. I only want to know if you care for me a little, Meg. I love you so much, dear, added Mr. Brooke tenderly.
This was the moment for the calm, proper speech, but Meg didn't make it. She forgot every word of it, hung her head, and answered,
I don't know,
so softly that John had to stoop down to catch the foolish little reply. He seemed to think it was worth the trouble, for he smiled to himself as if quite satisfied, pressed the plump hand gratefully, and said in his most persuasive tone,
Will you try and find out? I want to know so much, for I can't go to work with any heart until I learn whether I am to have my reward in the end or not.
I'm too young, faltered Meg, wondering why she was so fluttered, yet rather enjoying it.
I'll wait, and in the meantime, you could be learning to like me. Would it be a very hard lesson, dear?
Not if I choose to learn it, but...
Please choose to learn, Meg. I love you to teach, and this is easier than German,
broke in John, getting possession of the other hand, so that she had no way of hiding her face as he bent to look into it. His tone was properly beseeching, but stealing a shy look at him, Meg saw that his eyes were merry as well as tender, and that he wore the satisfied smile of one who had no doubt of his success. This nettled her. Annie Moffat's foolish lessons in coquetry came into her mind, and the love of power, which sleeps in the bosoms of the best of little women, woke up all of a sudden and took possession of her. She felt excited and strange, and not knowing what else to do, followed a capricious impulse and, withdrawing her hands, said petulantly,
I don't choose. Please go away and let me be.
Poor Mr. Brooke looked as if his lovely castle in the air was tumbling about his ears, for he had never seen Meg in such a mood before, and it rather bewildered him.
Do you really mean that? He asked anxiously, following her as she walked away.
Yes, I do. I don't want to be worried about such things. Father says I needn't. It's too soon, and I'd rather not.
Mayn't I hope you'll change your mind by and by? I'll wait and say nothing till you've had more time. Don't play with me, Meg. I didn't think that of you.
Don't think of me at all. I'd rather you wouldn't, said Meg, taking a naughty satisfaction in trying her lover's patience and her own power.
He was grave and pale now, and looked decidedly more like the novel heroes whom she admired,
but he neither slapped his forehead nor tramped about the room as they did. He just stood, looking at her so wistfully, so tenderly, that she found her heart relenting in spite of herself. What would have happened next, I cannot say, if Aunt March had not come hobbling in at this interesting minute. The old lady couldn't resist her longing to see her nephew, for she had met Laurie as she took her airing, and hearing of Mr. March's arrival, drove straight out to see him. The family were all busy in the back part of the house, and she had made her way quietly in, hoping to surprise them. She did surprise two of them, so much that Meg started, as if she had seen a ghost, and Mr. Brooke vanished into the study.
"Bless me, what's all this?"
cried the old lady with a rap of her cane, as she glanced from the pale young gentleman to the scarlet young lady.
"It's Father's friend. I'm so surprised to see you," stammered Meg, feeling that she was in for a lecture now.
"That's evident," returned Aunt March, sitting down. "But what is Father's friend saying to make you look like a peony? There's mischief going on, and I insist upon knowing what it is," with another rap.
"We were only talking. Mr. Brooke came for his umbrella," began Meg, wishing that Mr. Brooke and the umbrella were safely out of the house.
"Brooke? That boy's tutor? Ah, I understand now. I know all about it. Jo blundered into a wrong message in one of your father's letters, and I made her tell me. You haven't gone and accepted him, child," cried Aunt March, looking scandalized.
"Hush, he'll hear. Shan't I call Mother?" said Meg, much troubled.
"Not yet. I've something to say to you, and I must free my mind at once. Tell me, do you mean to marry this cook? If you do, not one penny of my money ever goes to you. Remember that, and be a sensible girl," said the old lady impressively.
Now Aunt March possessed in perfection the art of rousing the spirit of opposition in the gentlest people, and enjoyed doing it. The best of us have a spice of perversity in us, especially when we are young and in love. If Aunt March had begged Meg to accept John Brooke, she would probably have declared she couldn't think of it, but as she was peremptorily ordered not to like him, she immediately made up her mind that she would. Inclination as well as perversity made the decision easy, and being already much excited, Meg opposed the old lady with unusual spirit.
"I shall marry whom I please, Aunt March, and you can leave your money to anyone you like," she said, nodding her head with a resolute air.
"Highty-tighty! Is that the way you take my advice, miss? You'll be sorry for it by and by, when you've tried love in a cottage and found it a failure."
"It can't be a worse one than some people find in big houses," retorted Meg.
Aunt March put on her glasses and took a look at the girl, for she did not know her in this new mood. Meg hardly knew herself. She felt so brave and independent, so glad to defend John and assert her right to love him, if she liked. Aunt March saw that she'd begun wrong, and after a little pause made a fresh start, saying as mildly as she could,
"Now, Meg, my dear, be reasonable and take my advice. I mean it kindly and don't want you to spoil your whole life by making a mistake at the beginning. You ought to marry well and help your family. It's your duty to make a rich match, and it ought to be impressed upon you."
"Father and Mother don't think so. They like John, though he is poor."
"Your parents, my dear, have no more worldly wisdom than a pair of babies."
"I'm glad of it," cried Meg stoutly.
Aunt March took no notice, but went on with her lecture.
"This Rook is poor, and hasn't got any rich relations, has he?"
"No, but he has many warm friends."
"You can't live on friends. Try it, and see how cool they'll grow. He hasn't any business, has he?"
"Not yet. Mr. Lawrence is going to help him."
"That won't last long. James Lawrence is a crotchety old fellow, and not to be depended on. So, you intend to marry a man without money, position, or business, and go on working harder than you do now, when you might be comfortable all your days by minding me and doing better. I thought you had more sense, Meg."
"I couldn't do better if I waited half my life. John is good and wise. He's got heaps of talent. He's willing to work and sure to get on. He's so energetic and brave. Everyone likes and respects him, and I'm proud to think he cares for me, though I'm so poor and young and silly," said Meg, looking prettier than ever in her earnestness.
"He knows you have got rich relations, child. That's the secret of his liking, I suspect."
"Aunt March, how dare you say such a thing? John is above such meanness, and I won't listen to you a minute if you talk so,"
cried Meg indignantly, forgetting everything but the injustice of the old lady's suspicions.
"My John wouldn't marry for money any more than I would. We are willing to work, and we mean to wait. I'm not afraid of being poor, for I've been happy so far, and I know I shall be with him because he loves me, and I..."
Meg stopped there, remembering all of a sudden that she hadn't made up her mind, that she had told her John to go away, and that he might be overhearing her inconsistent remarks. Aunt March was very angry, for she had set her heart on having her pretty niece make a fine match, and something in the girl's happy young face made the lonely old woman feel both sad and sour.
"Well, I wash my hands of the whole affair. You are a willful child, and you've lost more than you know by this piece of folly. No, I won't stop. I'm disappointed in you, and haven't spirits to see your father now. Don't expect anything from me when you are married. Your Mr. Book's friends must take care of you. I'm done with you forever."
And slamming the door in Meg's face, Aunt March drove off in high dudgeon. She seemed to take all the girl's courage with her, for when left alone, Meg stood for a moment, undecided whether to laugh or cry. Before she could make up her mind, she was taken possession of by Mr. Brooke, who said, all in one breath,
"I couldn't help hearing, Meg. Thank you for defending me, and Aunt March for proving that you do care for me, a little bit."
"I didn't know how much till she abused you," began Meg.
"And I needn't go away, but may stay and be happy. May I, dear?"
Here was another fine chance to make the crushing speech and the stately exit, but Meg never thought of doing either, and disgraced herself forever in Joe's eyes by meekly whispering,
"Yes, John,"
and hiding her face on Mr. Brooke's waistcoat. 15 minutes after Aunt March's departure, Joe came softly downstairs, paused an instant at the parlor door, and hearing no sound within, nodded and smiled with a satisfied expression, saying to herself,
"She has seen him away as we planned, and that affair is settled. I'll go and hear the fun, and have a good laugh over it."
But poor Joe never got her laugh, for she was transfixed upon the threshold by a spectacle which held her there, staring with her mouth nearly as wide open as her eyes. Going in to exult over a fallen enemy and to praise a strong-minded sister for the banishment of an objectionable lover, it certainly was a shock to behold the aforesaid enemy serenely sitting on the sofa, with a strong-minded sister enthroned upon his knee, and wearing an expression of the most abject submission. Joe gave a sort of gasp, as if a cold shower bath had suddenly fallen upon her, for such an unexpected turning of the tables actually took her breath away. At the odd sound, the lovers turned and saw her. Meg jumped up, looking both proud and shy, but that man, as Joe called him, actually laughed and said coolly, as he kissed the astonished newcomer,
"Sister Joe, congratulate us."
That was adding insult to injury. It was altogether too much, and making some wild demonstration with her hands, Joe vanished without a word. Rushing upstairs, she startled the invalids by exclaiming tragically as she burst into the room,
"Oh, do somebody go down quick. John Brooke is acting dreadfully, and Meg likes it."
Mr. and Mrs. March left the room with speed, and casting herself upon the bed, Joe cried and scolded tempestuously as she told the awful news to Beth and Amy. The little girls, however, considered it a most agreeable and interesting event, and Joe got little comfort from them, so she went up to her refuge in the garret and confided her troubles to the rats. Nobody ever knew what went on in the parlor that afternoon, but a great deal of talking was done, and quiet Mr. Brooke astonished his friends by the eloquence and spirit with which he pleaded his suit, told his plans, and persuaded them to arrange everything just as he wanted it. The tea bell rang before he had finished describing the paradise which he meant to earn for Meg, and he proudly took her in to supper, both looking so happy that Joe hadn't the heart to be jealous or dismal. Amy was very much impressed by John's devotion and Meg's dignity. Beth beamed at them from a distance, while Mr. and Mrs. March surveyed the young couple with such tender satisfaction that it was perfectly evident Aunt March was right in calling them as unworldly as a pair of babies. No one ate much, but everyone looked very happy, and the old room seemed to brighten up amazingly when the first romance of the family began there.
"You can't say nothing pleasant ever happens now, can you, Meg?" said Amy, trying to decide how she would group the lovers in a sketch she was planning to make.
"No, I'm sure I can't. How much has happened since I said that? It seems a year ago," answered Meg, who was in a blissful dream, lifted far above such common things as bread and butter. "The joys come close upon the sorrows this time, and I rather think the changes have begun," said Mrs. March. "In most families there comes, now and then, a year full of events. This has been such a one, but it ends well, after all."
"Hope the next will end better," muttered Joe, who found it very hard to see Meg absorbed in a stranger before her face, for Joe loved a few persons very dearly, and dreaded to have their affection lost or lessened in any way.
"I hope the third year from this will end better. I mean it shall, if I live to work out my plans," said Mr. Brooke, smiling at Meg, as if everything had become possible to him now.
"Doesn't it seem very long to wait?" asked Amy, who was in a hurry for the wedding.
"I've got so much to learn before I shall be ready. It seems a short time to me," answered Meg, with a sweet gravity in her face never seen there before.
"You have only to wait. I am to do the work," said John, beginning his labors by picking up Meg's napkin, with an expression which caused Joe to shake her head and then say to herself with an air of relief as the front door banged, "Here comes Lori. Now we shall have some sensible conversation."
But Joe was mistaken, for Lori came prancing in, overflowing with good spirits, bearing a great bridal-looking bouquet for Mrs. John Brooke, and evidently laboring under the delusion that the whole affair had been brought about by his excellent management.
"I knew Brooke would have it all his own way. He always does, for when he makes up his mind to accomplish anything, it's done, though the sky falls," said Lori, when he had presented his offering and his congratulations. "Much obliged for that recommendation. I take it as a good omen for the future, and invite you to my wedding on the spot," answered Mr. Brooke, who felt at peace with all mankind, even his mischievous pupil. "I'll come if I'm at the ends of the earth, for the sight of Joe's face alone on that occasion would be worth a long journey." "You don't look festive, ma'am. What's the matter?" asked Lori, following her into a corner of the parlor, whither all had adjourned to greet Mr. Lawrence.
"I don't approve of the match, but I've made up my mind to bear it and shall not say a word against it," said Joe solemnly. "You can't know how hard it is for me to give up Meg," she continued, with a little quiver in her voice.
"You don't give her up. You only go halves," said Lori consolingly.
"It can never be the same again. I've lost my dearest friend," sighed Joe.
"You've got me, anyhow. I'm not good for much, I know, but I'll stand by you, Joe, all the days of my life. Upon my word, I will."
And Lori meant what he said. "I know you will, and I'm ever so much obliged. You are always a great comfort to me, Teddy," returned Joe, gratefully shaking hands.
"Well, now, don't be dismal. There's a good fellow. It's all right, you see. Meg is happy. Brooke will fly round and get settled immediately. Grandpa will attend to him, and it will be very jolly to see Meg in her own little house. We'll have capital times after she is gone, for I shall be through college before long, and then we'll go abroad on some nice trip or other. Wouldn't that console you?"
"I rather think it would, but there's no knowing what may happen in 3 years," said Joe thoughtfully.
"That's true. Don't you wish you could take a look forward and see where we shall all be then?"
"I do," returned Lori. "I think not, for I might see something sad, and everyone looks so happy now, I don't believe they could be much improved."
And Joe's eyes went slowly round the room, brightening as they looked, for the prospect was a pleasant one. Father and mother sat together, quietly reliving the first chapter of the romance, which for them began some 20 years ago. Amy was drawing the lovers, who sat apart in a beautiful world of their own, the light of which touched their faces with a grace the little artist could not copy. Beth lay on her sofa, talking cheerily with her old friend, who held her little hand as if he felt that it possessed the power to lead him along the peaceful way she walked. Joe lounged in her favorite low seat, with a grave, quiet look which best became her, and Lori, leaning on the back of her chair, his chin on a level with her curly head, smiled with his friendliest aspect and nodded at her in the long glass which reflected them both. So the curtain falls upon Meg, Joe, Beth, and Amy. Whether it ever rises again depends upon the reception given the first act of the domestic drama called Little Women.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.
Part 2, Chapter 24, Gossip. In order that we may start afresh and go to Meg's wedding with free minds, it will be well to begin with a little gossip about the Marches. And here let me premise that if any of the elders think there is too much lovering in the story, as I fear they may, I'm not afraid the young folks will make that objection. I can only say, with Mrs. March, what can you expect when I have four gay girls in the house and a dashing young neighbor over the way? The 3 years that have passed have brought but few changes to the quiet family. The war is over, and Mr. March safely at home, busy with his books and the small parish, which found in him a minister by nature, as by grace, a quiet, studious man, rich in the wisdom that is better than learning, the charity which calls all mankind brother, the piety that blossoms into character, making it august and lovely. These attributes, in spite of poverty and the strict integrity which shut him out from the more worldly successes, attracted to him many admirable persons, as naturally as sweet herbs draw bees, and as naturally he gave them the honey into which 50 years of hard experience had distilled no bitter drop. Earnest young men found the gray-headed scholar as young at heart as they. Thoughtful or troubled women instinctively brought their doubts to him, sure of finding the gentlest sympathy, the wisest counsel. Sinners told their sins to the pure-hearted old man, and were both rebuked and saved. Gifted men found a companion in him. Ambitious men caught glimpses of nobler ambitions than their own, and even worldlings confessed that his beliefs were beautiful and true, although they wouldn't pay. To outsiders, the five energetic women seemed to rule the house, and so they did in many things, but the quiet scholar, sitting among his books, was still the head of the family, the household conscience, anchor, and comforter. For to him the busy, anxious women always turned in troublous times, finding him, in the truest sense of those sacred words, husband and father. The girls gave their hearts into their mother's keeping, their souls into their father's, and to both parents, who lived and labored so faithfully for them, they gave a love that grew with their growth and bound them tenderly together by the sweetest tie which blesses life and outlives death. Mrs. March is as brisk and cheery, though rather grayer, than when we saw her last, and just now so absorbed in Meg's affairs that the hospitals and homes, still full of wounded boys and soldiers' widows, decidedly miss the motherly missionary's visits. John Brooke did his duty manfully for a year, got wounded, was sent home, and not allowed to return. He received no stars or bars, but he deserved them, for he cheerfully risked all he had, and life and love are very precious when both are in full bloom. Perfectly resigned to his discharge, he devoted himself to getting well, preparing for business, and earning a home for Meg. With the good sense and sturdy independence that characterized him, he refused Mr. Lawrence's more generous offers and accepted the place of bookkeeper, feeling better satisfied to begin with an honestly earned salary than by running any risks with borrowed money. Meg had spent the time in working as well as waiting, growing womanly in character, wise in housewifely arts, and prettier than ever, for love is a great beautifier. She had her girlish ambitions and hopes and felt some disappointment at the humble way in which the new life must begin. Ned Moffat had just married Sally Gardner, and Meg couldn't help contrasting their fine house and carriage, many gifts and splendid outfit with her own, and secretly wishing she could have the same. But somehow envy and discontent soon vanished when she thought of all the patient love and labor John had put into the little home awaiting her. And when they sat together in the twilight, talking over their small plans, the future always grew so beautiful and bright that she forgot Sally's splendor, and felt herself the richest, happiest girl in Christendom. Jo never went back to Aunt March, for the old lady took such a fancy to Amy that she bribed her with the offer of drawing lessons from one of the best teachers going, and for the sake of this advantage, Amy would have served a far harder mistress. So she gave her mornings to duty, her afternoons to pleasure, and prospered finely. Jo, meantime, devoted herself to literature and Beth, who remained delicate long after the fever was a thing of the past. Not an invalid exactly, but never again the rosy, healthy creature she had been, yet always hopeful, happy, and serene, and busy with the quiet duties she loved, everyone's friend and an angel in the house, long before those who loved her most had learned to know it. As long as the Spread Eagle paid her a dollar a column for her rubbish, as she called it, Jo felt herself a woman of means and spun her little romances diligently. But great plans fermented in her busy brain and ambitious mind, and the old tin kitchen in the garret held a slowly increasing pile of blotted manuscript, which was one day to place the name of March upon the roll of fame. Laurie, having dutifully gone to college to please his grandfather, was now getting through it in the easiest possible manner to please himself. A universal favorite, thanks to money, manners, much talent, and the kindest heart that ever got its owner into scrapes by trying to get other people out of them, he stood in great danger of being spoiled, and probably would have been, like many another promising boy, if he had not possessed a talisman against evil in the memory of the kind old man who was bound up in his success, the motherly friend who watched over him as if he were her son, and last, but not least by any means, the knowledge that four innocent girls loved, admired, and believed in him with all their hearts. Being only a glorious human boy, of course he frolicked and flirted, grew dandified, aquatic, sentimental, or gymnastic, as college fashions ordained, hazed and was hazed, talked slang, and more than once came perilously near suspension and expulsion. But his high spirits and the love of fun were the causes of these pranks, he always managed to save himself by frank confession, honorable atonement, or the irresistible power of persuasion, which he possessed in perfection. In fact, he rather prided himself on his narrow escapes, and liked to thrill the girls with graphic accounts of his triumphs over wrathful tutors, dignified professors, and vanquished enemies. The men of my class were heroes in the eyes of the girls, who never wearied of the exploits of our fellows, and were frequently allowed to bask in the smiles of these great creatures when Laurie brought them home with him. Amy especially enjoyed this high honor, and became quite a belle among them, for her ladyship early felt and learned to use the gift of fascination with which she was endowed. Meg was too much absorbed in her private and particular John to care for any other lords of creation, and Beth too shy to do more than peep at them, and wonder how Amy dared to order them about so. But Jo felt quite in her own element, and found it very difficult to refrain from imitating the gentlemanly attitudes, phrases, and feats, which seemed more natural to her than the decorums prescribed for young ladies. They all liked Jo immensely, but never fell in love with her, though very few escaped without paying the tribute of a sentimental sigh or two at Amy's shrine. And speaking of sentiment, brings us very naturally to the Dovecote. That was the name of the little brown house Mr. Brooke had prepared for Meg's first home. Laurie had christened it, saying it was highly appropriate to the gentle lovers, who went on together like a pair of turtle doves, with first a bill and then a coo. It was a tiny house, with a little garden behind and a lawn about as big as a pocket handkerchief in the front. Here Meg meant to have a fountain, shrubbery, and a profusion of lovely flowers, though just at present the fountain was represented by a weather-beaten urn, very like a dilapidated slop bowl. The shrubbery consisted of several young larches, undecided whether to live or die, and the profusion of flowers was merely hinted by regiments of sticks to show where seeds were planted. But inside it was altogether charming, and the happy bride saw no fault from garret to cellar. To be sure, the hall was so narrow, it was fortunate that they had no piano, for one never could have been gotten whole. The dining room was so small that six people were a tight fit, and the kitchen stairs seemed built for the express purpose of precipitating both servants and china pell-mell into the coal bin. But once get used to these slight blemishes, and nothing could be more complete, for good sense and good taste had presided over the furnishing, and the result was highly satisfactory. There were no marble-topped tables, long mirrors, or lace curtains in the little parlor, but simple furniture, plenty of books, a fine picture or two, a stand of flowers in the bay window, and, scattered all about, the pretty gifts which came from friendly hands and were the fairer for the loving messages they brought. I don't think the Parian Psyche Laurie gave lost any of its beauty because John put up the bracket it stood upon, but any upholsterer could have draped the plain muslin curtains more gracefully than Amy's artistic hand, or that any storeroom was ever better provided with good wishes, merry words, and happy hopes than that in which Joe and her mother put away Meg's few boxes, barrels, and bundles. And I am morally certain that the spandy new kitchen never could have looked so cozy and neat if Hannah had not arranged every pot and pan a dozen times over, and laid the fire all ready for lighting, the minute Miss Brooke came home. I also doubt if any young matron ever began life with so rich a supply of dusters, holders, and piece bags, for Beth made enough to last till the silver wedding came round, and invented three different kinds of dishcloths for the express service of the bridal china. People who hire all these things done for them never know what they lose, for the homeliest tasks get beautified if loving hands do them, and Meg found so many proofs of this that everything in her small nest, from the kitchen roller to the silver vase on her parlor table, was eloquent of home love and tender forethought. What happy times they had planning together, what solemn shopping excursions, what funny mistakes they made, and what shouts of laughter arose over Laurie's ridiculous bargains. In his love of jokes, this young gentleman, though nearly through college, was as much of a boy as ever. His last whim had been to bring with him on his weekly visits some new, useful, and ingenious article for the young housekeeper. Now a bag of remarkable clothespins, next a wonderful nutmeg grater, which fell to pieces at the first trial, a knife cleaner that spoiled all the knives, or a sweeper that picked the nap neatly off the carpet and left the dirt, labor-saving soap that took the skin off one's hands, infallible cements which stuck firmly to nothing but the fingers of the deluded buyer, and every kind of tinware, from a toy savings bank for odd pennies to a wonderful boiler, which would wash articles in its own steam with every prospect of exploding in the process. In vain Meg begged him to stop. John laughed at him, and Joe called him Mr. Toodles. He was possessed with a mania for patronizing Yankee ingenuity, and seeing his friends fitly furnished forth. So each week beheld some fresh absurdity. Everything was done at last, even to Amy's arranging different colored soaps to match the different colored rooms, and Beth setting the table for the first meal. "Are you satisfied? Does it seem like home, and do you feel as if you should be happy here?" asked Mrs. March, as she and her daughter went through the new kingdom arm in arm, for just then they seemed to cling together more tenderly than ever. "Yes, Mother, perfectly satisfied, thanks to you all, and so happy that I can't talk about it," with a look that was far better than words. "If she only had a servant or two, it would be all right," said Amy, coming out of the parlor, where she'd been trying to decide whether the bronze mercury looked best on the whatnot or the mantelpiece. "Mother and I have talked that over, and I have made up my mind to try her way first. There will be so little to do that with Lottie to run my errands and help me here and there, I shall only have enough work to keep me from getting lazy or homesick," answered Meg tranquilly. "Sally Moffat has four," began Amy. "If Meg had four, the house wouldn't hold them, and Master and Missus would have to camp in the garden," broke in Joe, who, enveloped in a big blue pinafore, was giving the last polish to the door handles. "Sally isn't a poor man's wife, and many maids are in keeping with her fine establishment. Meg and John begin humbly, but I have a feeling that there will be quite as much happiness in the little house as in the big one. It's a great mistake for young girls like Meg to leave themselves nothing to do but dress, give orders, and gossip. When I was first married, I used to long for my new clothes to wear out or get torn so that I might have the pleasure of mending them, for I got heartily sick of doing fancy work and tending my pocket handkerchief. Why didn't you go into the kitchen and make messes, as Sally says she does to amuse herself, though they never turn out well and the servants laugh at her," said Meg. "I did, after a while, not to mess, but to learn of Hannah how things should be done, that my servants need not laugh at me. It was play then, but there came a time when I was truly grateful that I not only possessed the will, but the power to cook wholesome food for my little girls, and help myself when I could no longer afford to hire help. You begin at the other end, Meg dear, but the lessons you learn now will be of use to you by and by, when John is a richer man, for the mistress of a house, however splendid, should know how work ought to be done, if she wishes to be well and honestly served." "Yes, Mother, I'm sure of that," said Meg, listening respectfully to the little lecture, for the best of women will hold forth upon the all-absorbing subject of housekeeping. "Do you know, I like this room most of all in my baby house," added Meg, a minute after, as they went upstairs and she looked into her well-stored linen closet. Beth was there, laying the snowy piles smoothly on the shelves and exulting over the goodly array. All three laughed as Meg spoke, for that linen closet was a joke. You see, having said that if Meg married that Brooke, she shouldn't have a cent of her money, Aunt March was rather in a quandary when time had appeased her wrath and made her repent her vow. She never broke her word, and was much exercised in her mind how to get round it, and at last devised a plan whereby she could satisfy herself. Mrs. Carroll, Florence's mamma, was ordered to buy, have made, and marked a generous supply of house and table linen, and send it as her present, all of which was faithfully done. But the secret leaked out, and was greatly enjoyed by the family, for Aunt March tried to look utterly unconscious, and insisted that she could give nothing but the old-fashioned pearls long promised to the first bride. "That's a housewifely taste which I am glad to see. I had a young friend who set up housekeeping with 6 sheets, but she had finger bowls for company, and that satisfied her," said Mrs. March, patting the damask tablecloths with a truly feminine appreciation of their fineness. "I haven't a single finger bowl, but this is a set-out that will last me all my days, Hannah says." And Meg looked quite contented, as well she might. A tall, broad-shouldered young fellow with a cropped head, a felt basin of a hat, and a flyaway coat came tramping down the road at a great pace, walked over the low fence without stopping to open the gate, straight up to Mrs. March, with both hands out and a hearty, "Here I am, Mother. Yes, it's all right." The last words were in answer to the look the elder lady gave him, a kindly, questioning look, which the handsome eyes met so frankly that the little ceremony closed, as usual, with a motherly kiss. "For Mrs. John Brooke, with the maker's congratulations and compliments. Bless you, Beth. What a refreshing spectacle you are, Joe. Amy, you are getting altogether too handsome for a single lady." As Laurie spoke, he delivered a brown paper parcel to Meg, pulled Beth's hair ribbon, stared at Joe's bib pinafore, and fell into an attitude of mock rapture before Amy, then shook hands all round, and everyone began to talk. "Where is John?" asked Meg anxiously. "Stop to get the license for tomorrow, ma'am." "Which side won the last match, Teddy?" inquired Joe, who persisted in feeling an interest in manly sports, despite her 19 years. "Ours, of course. Wish you'd been there to see."
"How is the lovely Miss Randall?" asked Amy, with a significant smile.
"More cruel than ever. Don't you see how I'm pining away?"
And Laurie gave his broad chest a sounding slap and heaved a melodramatic sigh. "What's the last joke? Undo the bundle and see, Meg," said Beth, eyeing the knobby parcel with curiosity.
"It's a useful thing to have in the house in case of fire or thieves," observed Laurie, as a watchman's rattle appeared amid the laughter of the girls. "Any time when John is away and you get frightened, Mrs. Meg, just swing that out of the front window and it will rouse the neighborhood in a jiffy. Nice thing, isn't it?"
And Laurie gave them a sample of its powers that made them cover up their ears.
"There's gratitude for you. And speaking of gratitude, reminds me to mention that you may thank Hannah for saving your wedding cake from destruction. I saw going into your house as I came by, and if she hadn't defended it manfully, I'd have had a pick at it, for it looked like a remarkably plummy one."
"I wonder if you will ever grow up, Laurie," said Meg in a matronly tone.
"I'm doing my best, ma'am, but can't get much higher, I'm afraid, as 6 feet is about all men can do in these degenerate days," responded the young gentleman, whose head was about level with the little chandelier. "I suppose it would be profanation to eat anything in this spick-and-span bower, so, as I'm tremendously hungry, I propose an adjournment," he added presently.
"Mother and I are going to wait for John. There are some last things to settle," said Meg, bustling away. "Beth and I are going over to Kitty Brandt's to get more flowers for tomorrow," added Amy, tying a picturesque hat over her picturesque curls and enjoying the effect as much as anybody.
"Come, Joe, don't desert a fellow. I'm in such a state of exhaustion I can't get home without help. Don't take off your apron, whatever you do. It's peculiarly becoming," said Laurie, as Joe bestowed his especial aversion in her capacious pocket and offered her arm to support his feeble steps.
"Now, Teddy, I want to talk seriously to you about tomorrow," began Joe, as they strolled away together. You must promise to behave well and not cut up any pranks and spoil our plans.
Not a prank.
And don't say funny things when we ought to be sober.
I never do. You are the one for that.
And I implore you not to look at me during the ceremony. I shall certainly laugh if you do.
You won't see me. You'll be crying so hard that the thick fog round you will obscure the prospect.
I never cry, unless for some great affliction.
Such as fellows going to college, hey?
Cut in Laurie with suggestive laugh. Don't be a peacock. I only moaned a trifle to keep the girls company.
Exactly. I say, Joe, how is Grandpa this week? Pretty amiable?
Very. Why, have you got into a scrape and want to know how he'll take it? Asked Joe, rather sharply.
Now, Joe, do you think I'd look your mother in the face and say all right if it wasn't?
And Laurie stopped short with an injured air. No, I don't.
Then don't go and be suspicious. I only want some money, said Laurie, walking on again, appeased by her hearty tone.
You spend a great deal, Teddy.
Bless you, I don't spend it. It spends itself somehow, and is gone before I know it.
You are so generous and kind-hearted that you let people borrow and can't say no to anyone. We heard about Henshaw and all you did for him. If you always spent money in that way, no one would blame you, said Joe warmly.
Oh, he made a mountain out of a molehill. You wouldn't have me let that fine fellow work himself to death just for want of a little help when he is worth a dozen of us lazy chaps, would you?
Of course not, but I don't see the use of your having 17 waistcoats, endless neckties, and a new hat every time you come home. I thought you'd got over the dandy period, but every now and then it breaks out in a new spot. Just now it's a fashion to be hideous, to make your head look like a scrubbing brush, wear a straitjacket, orange gloves, and clumping square-toed boots. If it was cheap ugliness, I'd say nothing, but it costs as much as the other, and I don't get any satisfaction out of it.
Laurie threw back his head and laughed so heartily at this attack that the felt hat fell off and Joe walked on it, which insult only afforded him an opportunity for expatiating on the advantages of a rough and ready costume as he folded up the maltreated hat and stuffed it into his pocket.
Don't lecture any more, there's a good soul. I have enough all through the week and like to enjoy myself when I come home. I'll get myself up regardless of expense tomorrow and be a satisfaction to my friends.
I'll leave you in peace if you'll only let your hair grow. I'm not aristocratic, but I do object to being seen with a person who looks like a young prize-fighter, observed Joe severely.
This unassuming style promotes study. That's why we adopt it, returned Laurie,
who certainly could not be accused of vanity, having voluntarily sacrificed a handsome curly crop to the demand for quarter-inch-long stubble.
By the way, Joe, I think that little Parker is really getting desperate about Amy. He talks of her constantly, writes poetry, and moons about in a most suspicious manner. He'd better nip his little passion in the bud, hadn't he? Added Laurie, in a confidential, elder-brotherly tone, after a minute's silence.
Of course he had. We don't want any more marrying in this family for years to come. Mercy on us, what are the children thinking of?
And Joe looked as much scandalized as if Amy and little Parker were not yet in their teens.
It's a fast age, and I don't know what we are coming to, ma'am. You are a mere infant, but you'll go next, Joe, and we'll be left lamenting, said Laurie, shaking his head over the degeneracy of the times.
Don't be alarmed. I'm not one of the agreeable sort. Nobody will want me, and it's a mercy, for there should always be one old maid in a family.
You won't give anyone a chance, said Laurie with a sigh.